And also for the luxury of having 45 minutes to speak. I'd like to talk about a number of results which lie in the intersection of differential geometry with the theory of convex bodies. And I have time to only mention three categories. But if the stuff I'm mentioning is interesting to you and you like more to see more details, please look at this website where you can find preprints for all the papers I'm talking about and details of the proofs, because today I have only time to give you, to communicate some of the main ideas. So the three categories I'd like to talk about is first, how to construct a smooth convex surface of positive curvature with prescribed submanifolds and tangent planes. The second topic is a solution to this so-called shadow problem of Wente, which leads to a new characterization for convex surfaces. And the third topic is skew loops and quadric surfaces. In particular, I'm going to discuss new characterization for ellipsoids. So I chose these results hoping that there may be something which is not only of interest to you, but maybe one day they'll be useful and you can apply them to solve some problems. Okay, let me start with the first topic. So, how to construct smooth convex surfaces of positive curvature with prescribed submanifolds and tangent planes. And Irvin reminded me a number of times that I need to be gentle when talking about curvature. So, positive curvature is easy. All it means is that through each point of the body, there passes a ball which contains that body. So what is the problem I'm talking about? Suppose I have a finite number of points and tangent planes. I'd like to construct this smooth convex surface which passes through all the given points and is tangent to the planes. But, you know, I may also have a curve with some number of tangent planes, and I'd like to construct this smooth surface, again, which contains the entire curve and is tangent. Or I may have, you know, some pieces of surface that I like to connect together smoothly and convexly. So how can one do this? Okay. Well, first of all, the problem has to be stated properly. So let me define a submanifold. And when I say submanifold, you can think of it either as a set of points or a curve or a surface in n-dimensional Euclidean space. I say it's strictly convex if for every point there is a supporting ball. And as Vitaly Milman reminded us, it's good to use good notation, so maybe spherically convex would have been a better terminology for this definition. So what are some examples of strictly convex submanifolds? Well, so in dimension zero, for a zero-dimensional strictly convex submanifold, take a convex polytope and choose a point in the interior of each facet of the polytope. In dimension one, you can just take a cylinder and construct a curve on that cylinder which rotates around less than two computer revolutions, right? Why is this guy strictly convex? Because at this point I can construct a sphere which contains all the other points. Similar, at each point here I can do the same. And in codimension one, you're just going to get, you know, for instance, any piece of a closed surface of positive curvature give you something which is strictly convex. And, you know, feel free to interrupt me anytime. You have some questions?
The last one was not strictly convex?
The last one is also strictly. Everything here is strictly convex.
On the cylinder, the curve?
This one is also strictly convex. Yes, you have to think about this a bit more. Yes, the endpoints are deleted. If you construct, if you put the endpoints in there, then it's not going to be strictly convex. And another condition is that the tangent to the curve should not be parallel to the direction of the cylinder. As soon as it becomes parallel, you get the curvature is going to be zero. The curve is going to be locally flat there, and you cannot support it by a sphere. So the main result for the first third of the talk is this theorem that suppose you have a compact CK submanifold. So CK means that each point of a submanifold has a neighborhood which can be parameterized using some K times continuous differential functions. Then M lies on a CK convex surface. Or, you know, because I'm in Rn, I should really talk about a hypersurface. But, you know, you can just think about it in C3. The result is very general, but let's just concentrate on R3. It's going to lie on a convex hypersurface of positive curvature with the same degree of smoothness if and only if M is strictly convex. This direction is trivial. It follows, for instance, from Blaschke's rolling theorem. The main direction is this one. Reference is this article in Journal of Differential Geometry. And I know I'm going to discuss some main ideas behind the proof. Another thing that I'd like to mention is that one can not only prescribe the curve, but you can also prescribe a finite number of tangent planes. Provided that these tangent planes are tangent to some supporting sphere. If this tangent plane is tangent to some supporting sphere, then you can construct this smooth closed surface of positive curvature. Sometimes I just say ovaloid, short for smooth closed surface of positive curvature, such that you also get that tangent plane in the solution. So the proof is very long and arduous, but you know, I hope to give you just some basic outline of how it goes. Basically, there are four stages to this construction. And, you know, in order to visualize this, suppose that my strictly convex submanifold is just a circle. And, you know, I want to extend it to a sphere, just for personal visualization. This outline that I'm putting up together works for anything. The first step is to construct a K minus 1 times differentiable vector field which generates non-singular support planes along your submanifold. So I know that at each point of my submanifold, there passes a supporting sphere. This supporting sphere is going to have a unit normal to it. I call this unit normal a non-singular support vector. And if you extend this vector just in any continuous way to a neighborhood of this point, again, these vectors are going to be non-singular support vectors. They're going to generate these supporting spheres. So you can basically slide these non-singular support vectors along a neighborhood of each point. And because we have compactness, we're going to have only finitely many neighborhoods. Then you can take a convex combination of these vectors over the on the overlap and construct this CK minus 1 differentiable vector field. So you get this CK minus 1 differential vector field, and then what do you do? Use this vector field to perturb the submanifold inside. So go some small distance in the opposite direction of these vectors. Construct a tube around that perturbed submanifold inside of the same radius epsilon. This tube is going to contain the original submanifold, cut a small strip from that tube. This small strip is going to be a germ of the solution. It's going to be a small piece of the final surface that we like to construct. Then what's the third step? The third step is to take this small piece that I have and extend it to a closed convex surface. But this closed convex surface is going to be only C1. However, it's going to have positive curvature in a weak sense. That is, at each point of it, there is going to be a small ball. And also, there is going to be a support bar outside. So let me also give you a basic idea how to do the third step. Start with this strip that you have. Again, perturb it inside. So you're going to get a smaller strip. At each point of this, there exists a supporting sphere. Take the intersection of all these supporting spheres. You get a convex body containing this small strip, and then come back by a distance of epsilon. You're going to obtain that object in the third step. So this object that I'm obtaining here is now smooth here, it's smooth here, and it's smooth on the strip. Oh, it's not smooth along where the place where the two surfaces meet. The final step is to smooth everything, but the smoothing is going to be tricky because you want to smooth everything without perturbing that submanifold. So how is that done? I'm going to give more detail for the fourth step. One main tool used here is this convolution. I really don't know what's a good name to call it. I guess Bergschneider vial may be a good name, because I've been instructed that the first one to write down this convolution was Berg, but then Weil was the first one to prove that this convolution preserves convexity at the request of Schneider, who later used this convolution quite a bit to in various papers and obtain other properties of it. So here, H is the support function of this guy. And you're going to convolve H with this approximate identity function. And the special thing about this convolution is that not only it preserves convexity, but it also preserves homogeneity. Right? For it to be a support function, it has to be a homogeneous function. The ordinary convolution messes up the homogeneity. So it doesn't send a support function to a support function. But this smoothing is very nice because it sends support functions to support functions. So you start with this guy, you take its support function, you convolve it. The new support function then is going to give me a smooth body. But then the convolution is going to perturb, so I'm going to get a convex surface, but it's going to perturb it everywhere. It's not going to keep it fixed on this submanifold that I have. So how can we rectify that? Well, so this is the surface I had in step four. I'm just drawing a cross section of it to make it easier to see. These are the non-smooth points, remember? This red bit is the surface I get when I apply that Berg-Schneider-Weil convolution. So just convolve it by epsilon. Remember, what was epsilon? Epsilon was the support of that approximate identity function. So you're going to get something convex. Now, glue this back to your original surface in a small neighborhood of the original submanifold. And I'm going to glue this back using a fixed step function. So the gluing is going to be independent of epsilon. Now, what happens as epsilon gets smaller? So I obtain this composite surface. The composite surface now is going to be smooth, except that it's not going to be no longer convex. But then I let epsilon become smaller. as epsilon becomes smaller, this composite surface converges to this blue surface that I had. And remember that the blue surface had positive curvature in some weak sense. So the curvature ultimately becomes a positive. So by Hadamard's theorem, the only closed surface of positive curvature is convex. And you're done. Okay. So that's it. 40-page paper in 10 minutes or something. If you like more details on this, I'll be glad to discuss this in person. So let me discuss some applications of it. Well, the first corollary is that you can suppose that you have a convex polytope, and the interior of each facet, you have some convex piece. Then you can construct this smooth convex surface in the interior, which touches each facet precisely along the prescribed sets. So suppose I have a single point here, and line segment, a convex piece here, a convex piece. I can smoothen this convex polytope while maintaining complete control of where this smoothing touches the facets of the polytope. So let me give you a quick outline of this proof. This lemma, again, might be of independent interest. The first step is to construct a convex function. So suppose I have a convex set in Rn. I claim that there exists some convex function f defined on Rn, which is zero precisely on the prescribed set, and the convex function is C infinity. So I claim that you can construct a C infinity convex function with prescribed zero set. The boundary of the zero set doesn't even need to be smooth. The way you would construct this is that for any unit vector, you have a unique support line with that vector as outward normal. Then you can construct this C infinity function, which vanishes on the half space containing the set, but is strictly positive on the other side. Then you add up all these functions. You add them up, for instance, by integrating over all the directions. And then what you get then is going to give you the desired surface. In fact, not only is it smooth, but it's going to have strictly positive curvature everywhere outside X. Okay, so keep this fact in mind. And now how do I smooth my polytope? Well, on each facet, I'm going to construct a plate. The plate is just the graph of the function I just described. Now, I'm going to cut a small rim of that plate. I do that for each face of the polytope. So I obtain a collection of these rings. If you do it properly, the collection of these rings is going to be a strictly convex submanifold, right? Remember what was the definition of strictly convex? That through each point, there passes a sphere, which contains the rest of it. So by the theorem I just proved, You can extend this to a smooth ovaloid. Now, each of these rings by the Jordan curve theorem is going to cut this ovaloid into two pieces. Pick the piece which borders on all of these things. And where are these plates that I had? And then glue these plates back to this piece. This piece is going to basically smoothly join together all the plates that you construct on these various faces. Okay, let me mention also another corollary, again another smoothing result. If you have a codimension 2 submanifold which is of class C31, so meaning it's 3 times differentiable and the third derivative is Lipschitz continuous. If you take it's a convex hull, then, right? Suppose that you take the convex hull of this guy. The convex hull is a topological sphere. This is a simple closed curve. So by the Jordan curve theorem, it's going to split the boundary of the convex hull into two pieces. I claim that if this surface is C31 regular, then each of the pieces of the boundary of the convex hull is C11. So it's one-time continuously differentiable, and in fact that derivative is Lipschitz continuous. That's another application of the result I just said. The proof, there's no way I can very quickly summarize it for you, but it ties together with this theory of degenerate Monge-Ampère equations. This is Hessian. Determinant of the Hessian equals zero. If you represent the convex hull as a spherical graph over some sphere, that graph has to satisfy some equation like this. So these degenerate Monge-Ampère equations have been extensively studied by Caffarelli, Nirenberg, Sprague, and Guan, and they knew of some regularity results provided that this equation has a solution which is strictly positive. It turned out that if a solution exists which is strictly positive, then from that you can obtain solutions with regard exact solutions using this continuity method in PDEs. You take some known solution, you deform it to get something else, so it ties up with that regularity result. Okay, so the first third of talk is over, and I'll be glad to take questions at the end of the talk. But, you know, you may also ask questions after each third, if you like. Well, you know, you can think about it and take me on the offer if you change your mind. Okay, so the second third. Right. So, sorry, I go, you know, a bit fast. Basically, I just want to, you know, throw out a number of results at you. You know, maybe some of it you find interesting more than others. Some of them might, you know, you run into sometime you need to use. So, basically, you know, that's my strategy for this talk. Okay. So, the shadow problem. What does the shadow problem say? Suppose I have some surface in space. At each point of the surface, I have a unit normal, n. Suppose I shine light on this surface. Then when I shine light on this surface, this light is going to cast some shadows on the surface. Right? I'm going to get some shadow here, some shadow here, some shadow here, right? Some areas are going to be dark. In fact, shadow is not a good term. Probably a better term would be shade, right? When I want to give some three-dimensional flavor to this surface, what do? I shade it. How can you precisely define shade? Shade are the points on the surface where the inner product with U is positive. So the basic question is that, you know, you have a surface. How much information can you obtain about the geometry and topology of it by studying these shades? And it doesn't seem that this concept has been studied at all, much less in a systematic way in pure math, although it's of a lot of interest in engineering, in computer vision. Engineers are very much interested in it, and there are lots of articles and books on shape from shading applications. So let me first give you some examples of shades on surfaces. Suppose I have a sphere and I illuminate it in various directions. Then what's the shade? Well, the shade is very boring. It's always a hemisphere. It always looks perfectly the same. But what if I have a non-convex surface? If I have a non-convex surface, at some points the shade could be connected. But if I illuminate in some other direction, I could have like two different pieces. I will get a disconnected shade. Also, at this point, I get a disconnected shade. Because remember, I defined the shade as the points where the dot product is strictly positive. But something special happens at these points. At these points, the set of points where the dot product is zero, those set of points are known as the horizon. The horizon is not the regular curve. There are these singularities, these places where you have crossings. Also, suppose I have a torus. Again, if I shine light from the top, I get a connected shade, but it's not simply connected. So also, I've been instructed to give plenty of background and topology. Simply connected, right? What does simply connected mean? Simply connected means that you can shrink every loop to a point, but you cannot shrink this loop to a point. So here I get a non-center-connected shade. And in fact, this torus has connected shades in all directions except in this direction, where I get two different pieces. Each of them is homeomorphic to a disk, and the two disks touch each other at four points. Okay, so what does this all have to do with convexity? Well, remember, look, the convex one is the only one where the shade is always in one piece. So it's very natural to ask, though it seems no one in convexity ever asked this question. The first person to ask it was H. Wente, who was studying soap films and was trying to solve this conjecture of Hopf, that are also bubbles round. Is the only surface of constant mean curvature a round surface? So that motivated him to consider the following question. Suppose that for each direction, the shade is connected. Does it follow then that the surface is convex? Any opinions? I've heard this talks by Frank Morgan. He asks a question and then he says, okay, everybody has to participate. Hands up and down as to, you know, which way people like to vote. Any guesses? True, false? Yes? If you commit yourself, then maybe it's more enjoyable, like watching a soccer game where you have a favorite team. So the game is... Okay. So the answer is yes, provided that each shade is simply connected or that the surface is topologically a sphere. However, in general, the answer is no. And the reference for it is this paper in the Annals. And so let me give you some idea behind this proof. Oh, incidentally, Peter Gruber mentioned in his talk how engineers have a great knowledge of mathematics. I was giving a talk to a computer vision seminar on this topic, and all the engineers guessed the wrong way.
So. But it is two-dimensional.
Right, exactly. Yes, thank you. In fact, that's one of the open problems. So I can solve the problem completely in three dimensions, but it can pose the problem in any dimension. And I really don't know what happens in higher dimensions.
Dimension will be different. This is the point where you cannot answer it, right?
Well, the short answer is that I don't know what happens in other dimensions. So possibly it could be different. But in other dimensions, there are various ways to phrase the problem. In dimension two, you just have connected shadows or simply connected shadows. But in higher dimensions, you have like various notions of connectivity. You can say that the homotopic groups vanish up to a certain order.
You know, all of us know one theorem about shadow. Can you guess what theorem all of us know?
The Cauchy, the recovering the surface area from...
Yeah,
which one is that?
If shadow, if border of shadow is flat, belong to subspace, then it is energy.
Oh, yes. They call that the grays.
But it is only from dimension 3. In dimension 2, it is wrong.
Oh, I see. Yes. I will have something to say about the border of the shadows. So anyways, so let me give you some ideas to how to prove this guy. So first, you need a rapid course in Morse theory. So, suppose you have a smooth function from some manifold to another one. I say that P is a critical point if the differential of the function vanishes at that point. Otherwise, the point is regular. Remember, the differential map is like a Jacobian. It's a linear transformation from one tangent space to another. If it's a degenerate, we say it's a critical point. X is a regular value if... every point in the pre-image is regular. The main theorem in Morse theory is Sartre's theorem, that almost every value of F is regular. And if X is a regular value, then the nice thing about it is that if you do a pullback, then you get a regular submanifold. This is like the implicit function theorem. And we say a function is Morse if the Hessian is non-degenerate at each critical point. So as the Professor Milman just mentioned, the theorem about the boundary of the shadow, so that's why I thought people here could be interested in this result. The engineers call it horizon. It is just a set of points where the inner product with the normal is zero. For almost every direction, it's a regular curve, right? Remember, it's not a regular curve for all directions. For instance, if you have a flat cylinder capped, you're going to get the horizon can have interior points and all that. But for almost every direction, it's a regular curve. And the way you prove it, you can form the unit tangent bundle, the set of all pairs where P is a point of the surface, and then you look at the unit tangent vector there. You have two natural projections, projection to the second component and the projection to the first component. It turns out that the horizon is just the composition of pi with tau inverse. So every value of u is regular. So by Sartre's theorem, you get the regularity of the horizon. So let me now just give you the basic idea for proving this shadow theorem. So the basic tool is these height functions. For every direction, every u, you can look at the function p dot u on the surface. It measures the height of the surface above a plane with normal u. Again, using the Sartre theorem, you can show that almost every height function is Morse. So what does it mean? If it's Morse, then every height function will have a finite number of critical points. So the number of critical points is finite for almost all u. So this integral is well defined. This is the average number of critical points of height functions. But how do you get these critical points? You get a critical point of the surface if and only if the normal is parallel to the direction of your height function. So the number of or antiparallel. So the number of critical points are exactly equal to the plus or minus the inverse image of the direction of the height function. But by the area theorem, this is the same as differentiating the area covered by the Gauss map, which is determinant of the Jacobian 2, because I'm including plus or minus 2. And this is just the Gauss curvature. The Gauss curvature is always bounded below by 4 pi because it covers the entire sphere. So this is going to be greater than or equal to 2. But the equality holds by the Chern Larshov if and only if the surface is convex. So if the surface is not convex, you will have a direction where you have a Morse height function, and you have at least 3 critical points. So the basic idea for so this is the direction that I get 3 critical points, call it 0, 0, 1. Take a vector which is perpendicular to this direction, look at the set of all the vectors that are perpendicular, and shine light in the directions perpendicular to you. I claim that one of those shadows has to be non-simply connected. That's the main idea for the proof. Take a direction where you have 3 critical points. Look at all the orthogonal directions. For one of these orthogonal directions, you should get a non-simply connected shade. So why is that? That's a little topological argument. So here, this is M. This rectangle represents M. I have 3 critical points. Note that whenever I shine light in the direction V, the boundary of my shadow always passes through P1, P2, and P3. So all these, so I get a one parameter family of these simply connected regions. All go through P1, P2, and P3. Furthermore, I can just wiggle U such that for one of these directions, the boundary of the shadow is regular. So I start from a disk, then I shine light in this direction, and I rotate it until I'm the other direction. What happens? This disk is going to go to its complement while staying simply connected. This is like some... It can't happen. So one way you can show it can't happen is that each of these shadows induces a permutation of these 3 points, because the surface is oriented. Suppose it's oriented by... You choose a normal. So if you choose a normal, then you have a sense of rotation in the plane. I can construct a triangle in this set, because the set is simply connected. It doesn't matter which triangle I choose, and I use my orientation, it's going to permute these 3 points one way. But now suppose that I rotate the light completely by pi, and I'm on the other side. So if I do this same construction again, I'm going to get another permutation. But these permutations depend continuously on the angle, and that is the contradiction. Okay, so that's basically the second third of the talk. Well, maybe a bit more than the second third, so the rest of it has to be a bit squeezed. Though I think I started about 5 minutes late. Okay, so if the shadows are simply connected, the surface is convex, but why is the word simply important, right? I claim that there exists a non-convex surface which has connected shadows, right? Here, the notion of simply is important. So let me construct for you a non-convex surface which has connected shadows. So how do you construct this surface? Construct a closed curve without any pair of parallel tangents, right? If you just, you know, draw a circle, the circle has plenty of pair of points where the tangent is parallel. But I claim that there exists a curve in space such that no two tangent lines are parallel. Construct a cube around this curve. I claim that the surface of this tube has connected shadows no matter where you shine light on. But of course, first one has to justify that such a curve exists. So I call these loops skew loop, right? So it's skew if gamma prime t cross gamma prime of s is never zero when t is not equal to s. You have no pair of parallel tangents. So how do we know that skew loops exist? This is how we can construct them. If you have any curve, you can look at the unit tangent vector. The unit tangent vector traces a curve on the unit sphere. Gamma is skew if and only if this curve that you get is 1 to 1. Right? If it has cross sections, means you have two tangents which point in the same direction. Also, T, if you take its antipodal reflection, it should not intersect its antipodal reflection. Because if you get two tangents pointing in the opposite direction, again you get two parallel tangent lines. So to construct this skew loop, start from a curve on the sphere which is embedded and avoids its antipodal reflection, and then integrate. But then the only problem is that once you integrate it, the integral may not close up. So how can you make sure that the integral closes up? Well, the integral closes up if this curve that you construct as the tangential spherical image has the origin is in its interior. Then you can distribute mass in such a way that the center of mass lies at the origin. Then when you integrate it, it closes up. This is like one of the tricks they always use in this convex integration. In fact, this construction is also mentioned in Gromov's book, Partial Differential Relations. There is a chapter there on this construction, but you have to know exactly where to look to find it. Okay, so they exist, and you can, in fact, give an explicit example. You can, you know, using a computer, it's not so hard to compute an explicit example of such a curve. And once you have an explicit example, then you can ask the computer to draw it. That's what it looks like. So why does it have connected shadows? Remember, the torus did not have connected shadows, right? Why does the torus fail to have connected shadows? Because if you shine line in this direction, these 2 points in a product is zero. So they separate this shadow from this shadow. But these 2 points are exactly the points where the tangent vector is parallel to the direction of light. You have eliminated this possibility. So you can have at most one fiber, and one fiber can never separate the torus into two different pieces. Okay, so I was at Stanford, and at the end of this talk, I had another conversation with Bruce Solomon of University of Indiana. And, well, I was already very pleased to have solved this problem. But these skew loops just turned into something else. One thing leads to another was the title of a talk once I heard by Bob Osserman. I guess it's also true of my research. I just do something unexpected, and another unexpected things happen. So it's been a very lucky time. And also, I think this area, intersection of convex bodies with classical differential geometry, is very fruitful. A lot of interesting problems there. Okay, so there exist these closed curves with nowhere parallel tangent lines. I just constructed them for you. It turns out, however, that you can never construct such curves on an ellipsoid. So just take an ellipsoid, draw a closed curve on that ellipsoid. That curve will always have a pair of parallel tangent lines. And ellipsoids are the only surface with this property. So crazily enough, this property characterizes ellipsoids. So I'm going to end the talk by a quick outline of this proof. This proof is very pretty, both directions of it. So all you need from differential geometry is the Gauss-Bonnet theorem. If you have a domain on some surface, if you compute the total geodesic curvature of the boundary and add to it the total curvature of that boundary, it adds to 2 pi. It's just a generalization of the theorem that the sum of the angles, exterior angles in the triangle, is 2 pi. So what happens if you have a closed embedded curve in the sphere where the total geodesic curvature is 0? Then this drops out, and k on the sphere is 1. So if you have a curve with total geodesic curvature 0, it splits the sphere into regions of equal area. And this is the idea you use for proving one half of the theorem. So no skew loops implies ellipsoids, and conversely, this direction is easier. It's enough to prove this direction for the sphere. Right? I want to characterize ellipsoids, but I claim that it's enough to prove this for a sphere. Why is it enough to prove for a sphere? Because these skew loops are invariant under affine transformation. Okay, so how do you do it for a sphere? Suppose I have a spherical curve, and then I have this tangent vector, which gives me a second curve. Now, translate each gamma to t. You're going to get a parallel vector field along t. So there's some duality going on. T is a tangent vector field along gamma, but gamma is orthogonal to t, so it gives you a tangent vector field along this tangential spherical image. Furthermore, gamma prime, what's gamma prime? Gamma prime is t. So the derivative of this vector field that you get is orthogonal to this surface. This is called parallel translation in differential geometry. The total amount that a curve parallel translates as you go around is equal to the total geodesic curvature. But this is a closed curve. So the total geodesic curvature is 0. So the tangential spherical image splits the sphere into equal areas, right? But if the areas are equal, then what happens if you take the antipodal reflection? It's going to intersect itself. And if the tantrix intersects its antipodal reflection, it means there are 2 points on the curve where the tangents were antiparallel, right? So this completes one direction of the proof. The other direction uses this idea of a Blaschke, which is a local version of this characterization for the ellipsoids. So you mentioned one characterization. Another characterization is that it's the only convex body with all the centers being centrally symmetric. I think maybe it was proved by a student of Blaschke. And then Blaschke proved a local version of that. Suppose you have a surface, and whenever you perturb the tangent plane intersects that surface in a centrally symmetric convex curve. Then a piece of that surface must be a quadric. So this, the other direction of the proof uses this. Also, it uses the fact that on any non-symmetric cylinder, you can construct a skew loop. This is a bit of analysis. Takes some work to do that. And the third step is that the skew loops are, in fact, open in the space of all curves. Why are skew loops open? If the two curves are closed up to second order, then the tangential spherical images are close up to first order. So if the tangential spherical image of one is embedded, the other one is embedded. And if it avoids the antipodal reflection, the other one avoids the antipodal reflection. So you can always perturb the skew loop a little bit. Okay, so I have a surface, right? I want to prove that no skew loops implies ellipses. Okay, I can go 30 more seconds. So the proof is by contradiction. Suppose the surface is not an ellipsoid. Then by Blaschke's lemma, there is a non-symmetric cross-section. So I can construct this cylinder. And by the cylinder lemma, I know that this non-symmetric cylinder is going to have a skew loop on it. Now, stretch the surface vertically by just multiplying the third coordinate by some constant. It's just some affine transform. You can stretch it as much as you want and make it as close as you want to the cylinder, then push that skew loop onto your stretched surface. Because the skew loops are open, this affine transform of this surface is going to have a skew loop. Once this affine transform has a skew loop, then the original surface must have a skew loop as well. Okay, thank you very much for your attention.